So it's my great pleasure to welcome Dominic Shaner back to Many Rivers Books and Tea.
Mm-hmm.
Hooray! Another musicology and music talk.
Mm-hmm.
I hardly need to introduce him to this audience, so I will say no more and ask him to begin, because I'm looking forward to it. Thanks so much for coming.
Great. Yeah, thank you. Thank you, everyone, for being here. I have some music, or some numbers to
numbers
online to pass out. And like I said, tonight I'll be mostly speaking. Last time, I guess most of you were here, trying to find a balance between speaking and playing. But the two talks this month are going to focus on two different sources of lute music that are both very telling in what was popular at the time, and then also very important in the music that they collected, and also important as to when they were, one being handwritten and then published. So they are kind of a wealth of knowledge in that sense. Because looking back, you try to understand how, you know, as a lute player, we have the instruments that survive, although they survive in kind of reincarnations of what they originally made. I'll get into that a little later. And then we have music that survives. We don't have any recording. We have written accounts of people playing. But oftentimes that could be accurate, or maybe a little exaggerated, or kind of tongue-in-cheek to try to, you know, put down their opponent so they could get the court job. But these...
That would be more than tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah. these sources, one being the Siena manuscript meaning it was handwritten, that's the one on the front there. And you could kind of tell by the scribe and the type of tablature which is which. The Siena manuscript was copied from about 1570 to 1590, and this is the time that I brought up last talk, when the Florentine Camerata was kind of taking shape. That group of kind of philosophers, musicians, artists eventually developed opera. So opera, the first opera doesn't survive, but the one we have, Monteverdi, in like 1605, writing opera. So there we have the transition from the Renaissance into the Baroque. And during this time, when Baroque mannerisms and Baroque musical style is sort of being developed, we have someone copying down a manuscript by hand. You know, that's 200 pages thick. So there's some dedication there, and maybe some resistance to the new musical style that's taking shape, or just writing down their favorite pieces. The second book, which you can see on the first one, it's in a nice kind of print. Instead of numbers, we have letters. Maybe you can make out an A, F's or E's. This is what is called the Garden of Music, and it was published in the 17th century. I should probably look on my fly. I think 1615 is when it was published.
I think
yeah,
that's what you
1615,
had
on. And this was published when Renaissance music was really not being played a lot, and in the Elias Mertel is the publisher of this, and in his introduction, he tells the player, or the owner of the book, that he spent many years collecting these pieces, arranging them, and we'll get into how these two sources are arranged, why they have certain pieces, the order of pieces that they have, kind of tell us about performance practice and styles. If you were going to hear someone play music, you know, maybe they're just playing from these books, and get this idea of what a concert may be like, or what a little musical interlude or afternoon may be like. But anyway, he tells the reader of the book, the lute player, he spent many years collecting these pieces, that yes, you could find some pieces elsewhere, but he's made these versions his own, which means he's added ornaments, you know, kind of taken a piece from someone and adjusted it here and there. But that this is his garden of music, of the finest pieces. And part of the reason that he explains as to why he's spending this time collecting it, because this one's even much larger. This is almost a 400-page volume. Parts 1 and Parts 2 were published together. He says that this art is dying. So the type of writing that he is collecting here was no longer in style. So this is kind of not well into the Baroque period, but Baroque musical form had taken hold throughout Europe, and we have this transformation from a polyphonic system where we have individual melodies weaving in and out to a kind of homophonic bass line with a chord and a melody. Basically, the Baroque style has, you could argue, has been unchanged to today. So pop songs today, you know, or even from the 60s, are Baroque style. You have someone playing chords and someone singing a melody above those chords.
So I'm just so curious as to what, if anything, we may know about the social contexts within which this change in musical tastes occurred. So is it like a straightforward generational thing? People born after X date in such and such a place tend to like it, or is it more like urban versus rural?
Yeah, economic plays a factor.
Okay.
So for example, we could tie in the history of the lute to this answer, that the lute came into Europe during the Crusades and the Silk Trade route. It did not develop from the guitar, which is a Greek instrument. In ancient Greece, they have a instrument called the kithara, which is not really related to the guitar, but you don't go far from kithara to guitar and kitara in Spain. So lute came from the oud, or al oud, or the wood, al oud, the lute, and initially was played with a plectrum, which is why when I play, my pinky is rested here, and initially it would be thumb and index holding a pick or a plectrum, alternating strings, like if you go see an oud player today, that's the technique they use. And this was quickly changed. No music survives for five-course lute with a plectrum. This quickly changed to dropping the plectrum and playing with the fingers, because this allows you to play polyphony, allows you to play more than one note at a time, which was the vocal style. Two different lines, one kind of cadences, one follows after, and you could really only do that with using all of your fingers. If you're playing with a pick, you could kind of get a sense of it, but not it wouldn't be clear. And then as the lute developed, they would add strings to it. So I say today that we have lutes that survive, but this is an arch lute, so it's a lute with an arch or a theorbode neck. And the lutes that survive today would be something like this, but this instrument probably was originally built as an eight-course lute with a bent-back headstock that you see so often in Renaissance art. They would knock that headstock off, you know, add this neck extension, rip off the small bridge, slap a large bridge on it, and then add more strings. So the lutes that we have survived have undergone two or three sort of transformations. The reason being is because to buy a new lute, you know, you wouldn't just, you know, every 20 years buy a new lute. That was pretty expensive. You already had to spend a lot of money taking care of the lute that you had, just for how delicate the instruments were and the conditions you were playing them in. So as music, as the styles change, you always have the professional players, you know, playing the up-to-date, the most current lutes. So at the time of both of these manuscripts, or the Siena manuscript, this instrument was just being developed. The so-called inventor, self-ascribed inventor, he writes in his book that he invented the arch lute, Piccinini, said he published a book in the 1590s and then again up into the 1640s. And he says he invented this instrument in the 1580s, 1590s, so he could get a low sound, and that it would, he actually played it with single strings with nails. And so he advocated for his playing style.
With nails?
With nails, just to get a louder sound. Because you can't play nails on a double course. One string will sound as opposed to both sounding simultaneously. So when this instrument was claimed to be developed, there's no surviving evidence. We don't have any diagrams of this instrument from, you know, that predate 1600. But anyway, if you believe Piccinini, this instrument was invented when this manuscript was being copied. And so you can consider this manuscript just the lute player that copied this manuscript, like the old style as opposed to the new, or the only lute available to them was their father's lute, or, you know, a lute in the family, and they couldn't go out and buy a new lute, so they had to stick playing the old music. But you quickly realize that this is not a singular kind of happening in the late 16th century, where we have Renaissance music being copied and printed. This is from Italy, whereas Elias Mertel's publication is from, you know, modern-day Germany. And so you have this example of people, even on lutes that don't fit the music, writing and copying music of an earlier time. So I included an example of that, anticipating Rob's question. If you turn to the very back, you see, you can almost, if you just compare the back page, this is from the same manuscript. I don't know if you wrote the folios on it. But if you compare the back to the front, even without knowing exactly what the numbers mean, you can almost see a different kind of shape in the music. And on the back you see, you know, a lot of numbers on single lines, and then it kind of goes across. You don't see, it's not really dense. It's not, you know, really thick. And so while this manuscript's being copied, you sort of see this transformation in style just in and of the music that's contained within. So on the back, we have something like this. So he's just playing little scales. If you look at the page right before that, the scribe has different examples. I'm going to play the seventh one down. We have three at the top, four, five, six, seven. So these little kind of thematic ideas. Here's number eight. And then again, number nine. So what this lute player is doing is he has, those are just little runs in a certain key that he has, you know, 9-10 examples of, and then on the following page he has what I believe to be are his own little examples of fantasias. And if you look at the first line at the top, he's added three little notes on what this is, an extra string. So the lines indicate strings, and you can count them. Most of the music occurs on six strings. And throughout the whole manuscript, most of it is fine just on six strings. But towards the end, the last, you know, 40 pages or so, you'll see examples where he has to, you know, add little ledger lines or lines to indicate a seventh string. So you can Does he have a seven-course lute? Is he writing for an eight-course lute? And we know that he has a lute that was probably a lute that was developed after most of the music was published that he hand-copied. And you get this example, another famous composer during this time that was alive and had the most kind of famous reputation and the highest paying court jobs was Capsperger. And he played, he wrote music for the arch lute, but his main instrument was theorbo. And he writes that, he and Piccinini knew each other and were kind of competitors in the musical world, but Capsperger wrote one book for a 10-course lute, and then all of his other stuff is for theorbo and arch lute. So he's someone that has taken the new style and kind of gone with it, and is not looking back. And his music speaks that. He has a famous piece that is. Redo my frets, but anyway, it's a toccata arpeggiata, which is basically chords. So we don't have any polyphony. Gives you a series of chords that then the player would arpeggiate and make up little patterns and create a piece out of it, kind of like a Bach toccata or something like that. And that piece was published in 1604, which is right between these two manuscripts. But why I want to talk about these books is because I think the most important thing we can learn from them and understand as a player is that what music was popular and how a lute player would kind of develop their art and how one would compose, how would one would the process of composition, how that would look. And we have an example of that, like I said, on the last two pages, where we have like the penultimate page, where we have the lute player just kind of writing down their little riffs or so. I'll play number 5. I'll play that again, but you sort of hear little motives that you kind of maybe kind of peek out, but that really don't go anywhere. And then it just kind of turns around on itself. And then we have number, let's see, if we go the second to last line after the squiggly. So we have something like that, and then falling right away. So it's really awkward writing. But you can kind of see these little building blocks that later he uses in his pieces. And when I look at this manuscript, I think that he has a whole bunch of pieces that the lute player is writing in, just copying from printed books or other manuscripts, and then he's saving the last 50 or so pages to kind of, while he's practicing, then write down his own ideas and see what works for him. And this is really telling in, if we go to the front again, the first piece. And if you turn it sideways, you could see Ricercata di Francesco M, maybe. but if you know from last time, this is Francesco da Milano, who was the most famous lute player of his time. Those of you that weren't here, quick introduction, is he was given the title Il Divino alongside Michelangelo. So Francesco and Michelangelo were considered equals in their art. The only two people in history to be given that title by the Pope or the Papal Court. So here we have a Ricercar, which is also a fantasia. Ricercar means, is an Italian word to seek out or to find. And I talked about it a little bit that last time, that this is to seeking out a little tune or a little motive or a few little notes. You have a little riff, like what this the scribe is writing at the back of his book, and then you take that and you figure out all different ways you can realize it or find it on the lute and create a piece out of it. The next page, if you just turn it over, we have La Compagna, so the companion to Francesco's Ricercar. And this is the first time that this piece occurs. So Ricercar by Francesco is a very famous piece by Francesco. It was published in during Francesco's life in 1536. It's given the number Ricercar number 33 because all of Francesco's pieces were either Ricercars or Fantasias. And it was, you know, published probably, you know, 10 times and is found in manuscripts up until the 1640s. La Compagna first occurs here and only occurs in a manuscript from the 1530s that was copied somewhere around Brussels. And then I believe actually later another version, but it's kind of more related to Francesco's Ricercar, was copied in England in the 1630s. And Arthur J. Ness, a famous American musicologist, gives Ricercar di Francesco number 33 in Francesco's complete works, and then La Compagna is number 34. But musicologists sense, and my teacher really thinks that La Compagna is not by Francesco, and I agree. I think it's composed by the scribe of this manuscript. And you can see in this page, we have, if you look right here, he had to write extra lines. He's kind of, you know, maybe he skipped a part or whatever his reference material was. He had to throw in some extra music, and then someone added the lines up here in between the two pieces. And I'll just play the opening section of Francesco's Ricercar. And this is a piece built upon this half step, which I talked about in the first presentation. I don't know how successful it was, but you will hear it even if you don't know it. This is his Ricercar is seeking out this little three note motive, something that rises and then falls. To La Compagna. Let me play it again. So could already hear how we have the original piece by Francesco then taken and kind of reworked or used as a template that then this lutenist at the end of the 16th century is using to learn how to write, to add their own ornaments, add these divisions. See how this further develops. I'll play section in Francesco's piece. Francesco's piece, you will notice that Francesco's piece has these little cadences, has these, he'll start an idea, he'll kind of weave it through the lute, it'll start up here, and it'll kind of find its way down, and it'll sort of resolve, or you'll have a breath. And then you'll start something new. Whereas the La Compagna just seems to kind of just keep going. It's just unraveling this idea that Francesco started, and it doesn't really give the lute player a break. So I'll play Francesco's piece from the top, and you can hear these little motives that are then imitated throughout the lute, come to an end, and then something new start up. Let me play a little section from La Compagna, and you can kind of see how the scribe takes those ideas and adds to it, and does make it his own. So I'll start from the added material on either side of the page margins. Another thing, I'll play that section again, and I want you to hear this idea that that even though we have Francesco's pieces being copied down again, and we don't just have Francesco, but we have, you know, many famous lutenists of the early 16th century being copied in this manuscript, Dentice, Marco dell'Aquila, and it's pretty obvious that whoever copied this manuscript really had a musical ear and knew who were the greatest lutenists. These lutenists were the most kind of technically advanced. They were the most prolific in how many pieces they published. And it was, so in that way, it was easy to acquire their pieces, but then they were very difficult pieces to play. And even though that this player has, copied this manuscript, has knowledge of the old style, you can almost hear a thinning out of the music. So even though I consider La Compagnia a more difficult piece, just because there's really no rest for the lute player, I have all these scales, I'm moving up and down, it's kind of fast, but we have a paring down of the polyphony. It's not as rich as Francesco's piece. And that is almost a stylistic concern of the time. With the Florentine Camerata, we have, instead of these dense voices that weave in and out of each other, we just have a chord that then the melody is going, you know, something like that. We change. So it's very lovely, but it's not as intense, you know, to listen to and to try to follow along. So I'll try to illustrate that, especially in these scalar sections where, yes, Francesco's only playing, you know, these runs, but if you listen to the bass line, there's this counterpoint that's happening that you have to sustain the whole time. And then I'll play La Compagnia, and you can hear the variation. So here's Francesco. That's Richard 33 in La Compagnia. And from this, if we look at what I believe is the next time that the manuscript pops up in your packet, I'll touch on this briefly. We have Francesco di Paraghi, and this is another Francesco piece that explores this semitone or this rising and then falling. Motive, and you'll notice what's unique about this, there are no measure lines. It's just all notes. We don't have any vertical lines separating out the notes. And what's interesting is calling him Francesco di Paraghi, which is in reference to when the Pope traveled to France and spent some time in Paris. He took Francesco along with him, and there was a famous lute player in Paris that was gifted pieces by Francesco. This was around the late 1530s, and here we have an exchange of music. So Francesco gave his music to the court lutenist in Paris, and then took back with him to Rome music from Paris. So we have this kind of exchange of musical ideas. And why this is interesting, that in this manuscript we have Francesco being referred to as the Francesco of Paris, is it tells us that this, that whoever copied this really did have a wealth of music and did have resources and access to multiple prints that are even now lost. There are pieces in the manuscript that are identified as by Francesco or by Dentice, that we don't have any, there's no concordance of it. We just have to take the manuscript, the scribe of the manuscript, that because of the other pieces, he was very accurate and there were no mistakes in the copying of these works by Francesco or other composers, that he must have had access to books that have now been lost. So this idea of taking a piece and sort of recreating it is not really considered when thinking of classical music. When you think of classical music, one may just think, okay, what's on the page, you just play it. You wouldn't change a note of Beethoven or any romantic composer. You wouldn't change Mahler's symphonies. He conducted them the way he wanted to and was very clear about what was going to happen when. But this wasn't the case in Renaissance and even Baroque performance practices. And this is just clear evidence of that, where we have a piece copied by Francesco and then a piece that obviously uses Francesco's original as a model and then recreates a new piece. It isn't given the name Francesco, it isn't ascribed to Francesco, but that's just the practice. That was almost a way of showing appreciation or honoring the lute player or the artist that came before you. And we have this example again in Elias Mertel's book. If you look on, we see Fantasies on page 140, number 9. This is another example of this kind of reworking of a piece by another composer. And oftentimes in kind of deciphering lute music, you have two people at work. You have the composer, who's also the performer, but then you also have the printer. So this collection of pieces was published by Elias Mertel, but he was sort of the collector. It's an anthology of pieces that that he enjoyed playing. But I think you have, not only did he collect it, and so you have his taste that we can clearly define by which pieces he collected here. After 400 pieces, you have a pretty good idea of what the individual likes. But here we also get an idea that it was common practice to, to arrange pieces your own way, to add notes. And this, number 9, is a Francesco da Milano Fantasia. So I will, as far as I can remember, play the Francesco piece. Something like that. You hear these outer voices imitating each other. Mm-hmm. Elias Mertel, Fantasia number 9. Two things. One, he's adding, he's not really adding anything musical. The structure is still the same. We have this, the imitation of this outer voice. He's just adding more notes to it, which would be called divisions. And then he's thickening up the harmony, which is adding little rhythmic trills at the end. So again, we see in 1615 not only a looking back to Francesco, but a sprinkling of, you know, the Baroque styles to this this Renaissance music that obviously Elias Mertel was fond of and copied, but then couldn't help by introducing these harmonies, which are kind of, really difficult to play. We just play it like this. But something that wasn't needed during Francesco's time, because instead of really focusing on vertical sound, or the changes of one chord to another, where you need this really full sound, a lot of notes, Francesco was following little lines of melody and then weaving them with other voices. So I'll play again Francesco's opening. Very simple, mostly just two voices. And then chords added seldomly. To a cadence. And then we have Elias Mertel's. Continues this in a really interesting piece that we will look at, number 21, which is on page 9. It's in his section of preludes, and here we'll talk about how music was how music was organized for performance. So in both of these sources, we don't have any dances. And it's well known that lute players would accompany celebrations, weddings, dances. It wouldn't be one lute player accompanying a dance. A lute's too soft. But there's depictions of drawings of stage design, and even in writings where you have 20, 30, 40 lute players of all different sized lutes accompanying a dance. And the reason we don't have dances here is dances weren't really considered a kind of a high art. Dances were composed around chord progressions or little bass lines, no more, oftentimes just no more than four notes. And so a professional lute player would be able to, you know, have this bass line and then improvise something around it. And, you know, make up their own little accompaniment to the dance. Francesco did not, well, he probably played dances, but no dances survived by him. Other composers, Marco dell'Aquila and Dentice that I mentioned, no dances survived by them. The Siena manuscript does not include any dances. What it does include, which I didn't print here, but it includes these really florid runs, really fast and high, that were probably solo parts to another lute player playing some chord progression. And Elias Mertel's print does not include any dances. Elias Mertel's print, I said, was in two volumes, the first one being Preludes, and the second volume being Fantasias and Fugues. I don't believe this is the earliest use of the word fugue, but fugue, the fugue style and compositional process that a fugue employs developed out of lute music. So Bach's fugues, where you have one guitar tuning, one idea that is then repeated like a canon or a round. We already kind of saw this in the Francesco pieces, but using much smaller musical material. Not to say that Francesco couldn't do it, but the process of the time was this imitation of small musical motives, something that you could sing. I mean, you could sort of sing that these Bach fugues, but Bach has these lines that are almost you know, super challenging to pay attention to that fugue, and then when another voice enters, you sort of get lost in the place of the piece. And why these two composers and publishers are collecting these specific pieces, I think we can answer that by just saying that this is music that was performed for an audience. Listen to music. So we have a lot of audiences that, you know, lute was playing to dancers. So maybe everyone was gathered. The purpose of that was to dance or to, you know, celebrate someone's wedding or something like that. We have examples of lute players, two or three lute players playing together, or some are playing chords, and then someone, like I said, in the Siena manuscript, that these really florid runs, these little scales, were celebratory pieces for the ceremonies in Medici and Milan and the families in power at the time there. But to try to figure out what pieces were played when a lutenist sat down to give a concert, or these descriptions of Francesco sitting down after a meal, tuning his lute, and while tuning his lute, everyone just sort of just becomes silent and then begins to seek out a fantasy. Well, this is an indication of the sort of music that he would play when giving a solo concert, even though that the concert is sort of a 19th century kind of idea. But that didn't mean that a lute player wouldn't play for a group. And we also have descriptions of Francesco playing playing to the Pope in his private residence, you know, in evenings or in the morning. And we can probably infer that this repertoire, this kind of slow-moving, polyphonic, kind of weaving melodic lines, was the repertoire that was used during those times. And to close, we have another example of Elias Mertel as composer. So on the Preludia on page 9, at the bottom, number 21, so the 21st prelude, and I guess I should mention a few quick things. The organization of these books is by mode, is by key, which at the time was not necessarily a new idea, but it was being solidified into you had modes, you had these little scales and groups of notes that you can rearrange and order, and you can think of it as a funneling down of the modes that. You know, you had 15 or 20 in the Middle Ages, and the Renaissance, you had about, 12 or 16, and then by the Baroque, you had your major keys and your minor keys. And that's how both of these sources are arranged. And the reason for that, I don't know if I've talked about it before, but has to do with tuning. Is if you this is another kind of sort of proof or indication that these books were performed from, is that if you were tuning, you would have to tune your lute according to the mode. The lute wasn't tuned in equal temperament, where we have the same space between every note. That was an idea that Bach sort of solidified. But with the lute, you have movable frets, which allows you to have a major semitone and a minor semitone. If you remember that. So the lute player, if I was playing from this section of Preludia, which is in C, I would adjust all my frets accordingly, and I have 15 pages of music that I could play before I would have to readjust my frets to play in tune. So that's a clear indication of performance practice and maybe how pieces were organized for public performance. But here, number 21, we have a piece by Michelangelo Galilei, who is the son of Vincenzo and the brother of Galileo. And interesting, we're just talking about equal temperament. Vincenzo Galileo, Galilei, was a famous musician and kind of scientist. His son Galileo took that kind of spark that his father had and ran with it. Vincenzo was part of the Florentine Camerata, wrote tons of lute music. Most of it is not very good. It's very academic. He writes how to play in all different keys on the lute without moving your frets, which at times doesn't really work, but it's more of a theoretical kind of process that he's guiding the player through. And as I mentioned, he's part of the Florentine Camerata that helped usher in the Baroque. But his son, Michelangelo, was a lute player, was pretty famous, but was lost the court jobs to Capsperger and Piccinini that I already mentioned. So here we have a prelude by Michelangelo, and I'll play the opening of that. And here we have Michelangelo being a Baroque composer, and you could hear the stylistic difference between this and the pieces by Francesco. Thank you. Again, but before I do, here is the first fantasia in Elias Mertel's book that only occurs here. Hear the opening. Is taken directly from Michelangelo Galilei's prelude. And so I'll play it again. I want to, if you want to follow along with the music, you can. I'm adding some ornaments, but if you look at the first line, we have notes where they're kind of all stacked on top of each other. We have a D, B, B, C, D, and I'm right here. And in this music, in both of these manuscripts, we have two different types of lute tablatures. So I mentioned in the Siena lute book that the lines indicate strings, the numbers indicate where to put your fingers on those strings. Zero is open, one, two, three, four, five, and so forth. Numbers indicate the frets. In Elias Mertel's, the same sort of, theoretically the same system applies, but instead of lines, we have spaces indicating strings, and we have the alphabet indicating where to put your fingers. So we have A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and so forth. Also, the versions are flipped, where in the Siena lute book, this is the highest note, and this is the low string. And in Elias Mertel's, we have here's the high string, and here's the low. The other thing which you may recognize are the rhythm signs. Here in the manuscript, we have what look like flags, or if you have an eighth note or a sixteenth note, we have just those marked above the music. And they are only marked where they change. There's no reason to spend all your time writing, what could be an eighth note or a sixteenth note over and over and over again. If you have runs of, 20, 30 notes, you just that rhythm sustains until you have a new one. The same process is applied in Elias Mertel's print. And we have what are clearly eighth notes, if you're familiar with that notation, and then 16th notes or eighth notes with, extra long flag, and then we have 32nd notes with three squiggles. Also, in the manuscript, in the printed book in Elias Mertel's, you can see dots sort of under the notes. And that's to indicate fingering. That's to indicate right hand fingering. The lute coming from the oud, initially played with the plectrum in this motion, dropped to the plectrum, and use this technique with the thumb alternating with the index. The thumb is obviously a heavier digit and then also has gravity in its favor. So you have a loud or a heavy and a light stroke. And so the index is the dot. And in Elias's piece, we have the dot in places that wouldn't be there during Francesco's time. And the reason for that is because we have the evolution of the lute. So we see that already in Elias's piece. If you look and remember that this is the high string here, that then the low strings below, we have the spaces indicating strings, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 7 is an A that just occurs right below. But then we have these A's with two little slashes above them. You know, that's just to indicate, okay, not this, you skip two strings, then you play that open. You skip two, you play that one. So that was a tangent just to describe that these pieces, if you look at 21 and go kind of, you know, towards the end, the last four measures, you see these chords above a what is a half note or a hollow note with a stem. And I'm interpreting that how Capsberger would. So instead of just playing, which is lovely, maybe I should rethink how I play it. I play it like this. So I do what Capsberger did, is took out arpeggiata. You can take what was obviously a performance practice of the time and kind of apply it to this piece, whether or not it's described on the page. The other thing that was popular at this time, which you would never do in Francesco's pieces, so if I played Francesco's piece like this, it gives a whole new kind of stylistic kind of flavor to it, which I think is kind of French Baroque. If you hear, let's see, what's a good example of that? Little trills at the end of a phrase. That was not something a lutenist would do in the Renaissance, because that just muddied up that line. That the note doesn't go between the two. The note goes here and then comes back up. It's an idea I think I talked about in the first one, where if you were to sing, you would sing and hit the note. You wouldn't hit the note with vibrato and hit the four or five notes all around that one note. It was this kind of pure tone, where vibrato was used, but was used for effect, was used as an ornament. It was an extra musical thing where, you know, you would hit the note, and then maybe after sustaining it, you would kind of blossom into a little bit of a vibrato. But you were considered a lazy singer or an untrained singer if you couldn't hit the note and just sustain that one note without hitting all the little notes around it. But whereas in the Baroque, with this Michelangelo piece, you can hear these sort of slurs, arpeggiatas, and appoggiaturas, where thank you. So I'll play this one final time, and you can listen for these. I'll actually play the Francesco piece as a little intro. They're both in the same mode, and you could hear the stylistic change and development, but also in mind with keep in mind that these pieces were collected and published alongside each other, which the kind of thread in all these talks is the legacy and try to identify who Francesco is, and we can't just look to hit what he published during his life, but his the word's escaping me right now, but his character and his fame as it continued to grow after he had died. And both of these sources of lute music bear testament to that by publishing numerous pieces that Francesco wrote. You know, Francesco died in 1543, so the first one is already 50 years after he had died, 70 or so, or 80. And not only that, but they're finding it necessary to republish Francesco's work when the style had totally changed, and almost rewriting Francesco's pieces to kind of fit more closely with the Baroque style. So as we heard briefly in Francesco's Fantasia and Elias Mertel, thickens the counterpoint, adds these chords that would have kind of appeased the ears of the Baroque musicians to hear these chord changes. So it's a really fascinating thing to contemplate and to try to understand why. We will never know, but we have pretty clear ideas what may have influenced both of these individuals that were years apart and miles apart. And I'll start with the Francesco Fantasia and lead into the Michelangelo Galilei prelude. Questions, feel free to ask. Yes.
Well, You said you was called Il Divino by the Pope.
Yeah.
And yet, I don't. Was like Michelangelo actually used biblical imagery and religious, but it doesn't sound like the lute was used in that way.
No. Yeah. Correct. But you know, using religious imagery could be pretty, you know, as a visual artist, it's pretty simple to draw that line. What Francesco did, he composed this music. He wasn't allowed to play in a church, so the lute would not be allowed to play during the Mass. Maybe the organ, but really you only had the purity of the human voice. But a lot of Francesco's music, I may have misspoken, I don't know if I said if he only published Fantasias and Ricercars, but he also wrote intabulations, which are taking a vocal piece and to put it into tablature, to intabulate it. And he intabulated a lot of sacred music, you know, like Ave Maria, Pater Noster, so parts of the Mass that were composed by Josquin du Pré or other composers around the time. You know, you can only imagine how difficult those are. You're playing, you know, four or five, six part pieces on the lute. So that was something that Francesco did play. And but his role, he was hired in the to the papal court. His father was a lutenist before him, and also worked for the Pope. And Francesco was hired when he was about 14, and spent his whole life there. He was a much better lutenist than his father. Really, before Francesco, there was no one published as much as he did. So maybe you could say, well, no one had the wealth of the papal court behind them to publish all this music, or the influence of the papal court that, you know, families wanted to publish the lutenist that the Pope loved, because then they would gain favor, things like that. I mean, there were political motivations for publishing lute music. So there was a lot of reasons as to why Francesco had favor in the papal court. But his legacy is beyond that. There were lutenists in the lowlands and in England and in France that recognized his skill and wanted his music. And I'm not really clear as to why he was given the title Il Divino, but there is I'm forgetting the name, but there is an astronomer to the Pope writes about Francesco, and interesting enough, he was buried at this famous cathedral where La Scala, the famous opera house in Milan, now stands.
I was wondering, you talked about equal temperament,
mm-hmm.
and the development of that theory. I was taught that the development of homophonic was intertwined with the development of equal temperament, because it allowed, for example, the playing of a major chord anywhere.
Yes.
In the range, and it would always sound like the same major chord, because you didn't have the... you didn't have different types of whole steps, or
yeah.
different types of thirds, major
mm-hmm.
thirds. You know,
that's mostly correct, but that's looking at it from about like 1750. So by around that time, because Monteverdi's operas were all could be played in an equal temperament scale,
mm-hmm.
And in a tempered scale, would be in both, because he wouldn't venture outside of that little narrow. Those keys that sounded good,
right?
But then as you get further in the Baroque, players wanted to, you know, transpose, or mm-hmm. you know, have one piece start in one key and then go somewhere else, which would sound totally out of tune if you had untempered scale.
We're talking about 80 years after.
After, yeah.
You're talking
but this,
about.
But okay. When it first started, the idea first started. You know, players were experimenting with equal temperament and transposition and things like that in the early 1600s. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's most people believe it started on on the fretboard, because that's the easiest.
Because
you can move your frets and you could just physically change it relatively easily, rather than, you know, on a keyboard instrument where you'd have to, you know, change the stop string length, or on an organ where you'd have to order new pipes, you know.
I see. Okay, thank you. I was wondering about that connection. Mm-hmm. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Yeah.
So the violin, what's the relationship of the lute to the violin in this development that you're
talking
about?
Nothing really the violin, but the viola.
Oh, okay.
Which predates the viols. You have a viola da gamba, which is, you know, this one.
Mm-hmm.
Viola da braccio, which is like the violin.
Mm-hmm.
There's a in Spain, viola da mano, which is a lute.
Hmm.
And then there's a publication of Francesco for lute or viola da mano. And it has a viol turned sideways like this. The viols were fretted. The violins are not fretted. Viols also had the same tuning as the lute and had six strings.
Okay.
So they are very closely related. The interesting development in Spain is that we have books for viola da mano and vihuela. And that comes at a time where you have the Spanish Inquisition kind of having influence over Spain. You have an interesting set of lute players. I call them lute players. They didn't play the lute. They played the viola da mano or the vihuela, but most of their music is highly religious. So songs with gospel verses, you know, about, there's like really cool songs about that passage where Jesus and the disciples are in the waters on the boat, and the waters start getting turbulent, and the lute's kind of playing these arrhythmic things to the singer. So you have this really interesting narrative of the development of the lute, where the lute is obviously a Moorish, an Eastern instrument. You could tell by the shape. You could tell by a lot of the times the design in the rosette.
Hmm.
And when they're converting mosques to cathedrals and wanting to get rid of the Moors, like, okay, well, let's just change the lute. We'll keep everything the same, all the strings and the frets, but we'll make the body look like a guitar, which is a Western thing, which we're going to reinforce the ancient Greek Western kind of line and help that.
Wow. I had no idea ideology played such a big role.
Yeah, and so the vihuela books were published from the 1530s to the 1570s, and then no one else played the vihuela after that. And it was literally a six-course lute, all the characteristics of a lute except the body of what looks like a guitar. And so the viols are very closely related to lute, and they died out for the same reason, is that because they were fretted, they were bowed, they had thick strings, their volume was limited.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because you couldn't, if you have six strings, you can't put a lot of tension on the instrument, it'll snap. Then frets were taken away, strings were cut down to four. You have violin, which you can play faster, you can play louder.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with the lute, it's too big, too soft.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, that was wonderful. It's fascinating.